The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Welcome to Obamagate.
We are finally seeing the unraveling of what could prove to be one of the biggest political scandals in American history. The Obama administration intentionally abused FBI authority to interfere with the peaceful transition of power.
The Wall Street Journal's Kimberly Strassel helps us to understand why General Flynn became the FBI's sacrificial lamb.
Flynn, as the former director of military intelligence, was one of the few people that would likely be in a position as national security advisor to unravel what the FBI and the intelligence agencies had been doing with regard to Trump.
We'll also look at the killing of Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia. It was a terrible injustice, and the media story around it isn't making it any better.
Did Obama's anti-cop rhetoric get blamed for the death of execution-style killing of cops in New York, in Dallas, and in Baton Rouge, Louisiana? Is this thing on?
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com, and let me invite you to join us now by video. And follow me on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. The Russia collusion hoax against President Trump keeps on rolling. It's gone so far as to seriously implicate former President Obama in the setup of General Michael Flynn, giving rise to the hashtag Obamagate. Most of the elite media are ignoring this, and no one on the responsible right is saying that President Obama committed a crime, but there's lots of hard evidence of lots of wrongdoing by people in and around the Oval Office.
Mr. President, in one of your Mother's Day tweets, you appear to accuse President Obama of the biggest political crime in American history by far. Those were your words. What crime exactly are you accusing President Obama of committing, and do you believe the Justice Department should prosecute him?
Obamagate. It's been going on for a long time. It's been going on from before I even got elected. And it's a disgrace that it happened. And if you look at what's gone on, and if you look at now all of this information that's being released, and from what I understand, that's only the beginning. Some terrible things happened, and it should never be allowed to happen in our country again.
This is one of the two huge scandals that have recently hit us. China, whose culpability on coronavirus is without question. Now the CCP of the PRC is trying to defraud our university research community of technical secrets. And then we have the explosive disclosures on Obamagate. What is Obamagate? I say the intentional interference with the peaceful, seamless, cooperative transition of power between presidential administrations. On Tuesday, I spoke with Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton about both.
What is going on at the University of Arkansas? Your home state Razorbacks are on the take from the CCP.
Hugh, it's very troubling news. It's just announced yesterday. A University of Arkansas professor of electrical engineering has been charged with wire fraud, but it's clearly related to the Thousand Talents Program of China, which is an espionage program the Chinese government uses to pay for American technology and expertise and trade secrets. This is very similar to the charges that Charles Lieber, the head of Harvard's chemistry department, faced in January. But judging by the complaint, this professor has been aiding the Chinese Communist Party in advanced technologies like semiconductors or heat and weather-resistant packaging for electronics, fuel cells, all the kind of cutting-edge technology that China has made a priority to try to take from the United States and then leap ahead of us.
Buried at the bottom of the Times story, it says he worked on power grid security research.
Yeah, it's very, very worrisome, Hugh. But here's the real crime, Hugh. The act of taking this money for people like Simon Ong at the University of Arkansas or Charles Lieber at Harvard is not a crime. It is perfectly consistent with U.S. law to take money from Chinese Communist Party affiliated entities and then to aid them in the development of these technologies. That's why Simon Ong is charged with wire fraud. That's why Charles Lieber was charged with a kind of misrepresentation fraud on federal grants. I'm going to introduce legislation that would simply make the conduct crime, Hugh. We ought not to allow our very best scientists and researchers and professors, almost all of whom either at all times or at many times are conducting federally funded research from the Department of Defense and the Department of Energy, the intelligence community, the National Science Foundation. We ought not to allow them to also be on retainer to Chinese Communist Party officials, giving access to all of that technology which American taxpayers have been paying for. There's so much technology that has been pilfered from our universities and from our laboratories about which we don't know. If you read the complaint against Simon Ong from the University of Arkansas, you'll see that he kept the University of Arkansas in the dark about this, as Charles Lieber appears to have kept Harvard University in the dark. So they are in many ways victims, just like the taxpayer are.
Yeah, the new Alger Hisses are not going to be at the State Department. They're in America's universities. Let me ask you, Senator Cotton, before we run out of time, I have read Sally Yates's statement to the Office of Special Counsel. It's Exhibit 4 in the documents dismissing the Michael Flynn prosecution. It's stunning. I mean, anyone who comments on Obamagate without reading this is just simply being stupid. Have you had a chance yet to read it?
I have, you, and I think Sally Yates, who, again, is no Trump supporter, no Republican, kind of indicts so many of her peers from the Obama administration, given the fact that Barack Obama knew about this call with Michael Flynn and the Russian ambassador before she did, and apparently may have been directing the FBI to continue this kind of activity. That's why, by all appearances, he kept Jim Comey and Sally Yates behind on the now infamous January 5th, 2017 meeting, because he knew that they would both still be in the government after the inauguration of Donald Trump.
Well here's my question, though. The attorney general or the acting attorney has to sign off on the FISA warrant that allows the Russian ambassador to be monitored. So Sally Yates, I think Sally Yates had to sign off on that unless they didn't get a FISA warrant. I don't know how long she was acting AG for, but it expires usually in December. Have you looked at that timeline yet?
I don't know the exact timeline, Hugh, or when those might have expired. I do know that there's still more information to be disclosed. I think there may be more disclosures coming today. But we are finally seeing the unraveling of what could prove to be one of the biggest political scandals in American history, that the Obama administration intentionally abused FBI authority to interfere with the peaceful transition of power.
Kimberly Strassel of The Wall Street Journal has been following all things Flynn, Russia, and the Mueller special counsel and the resulting impeachment for years, something like a voice crying in the wilderness. Strassel joined Dennis Prager this week.
Do you know anything now you didn't know 2 months ago?
Yes, I think we've all learned a great deal about this Flynn case that we didn't know 2 months ago, but not the central point. And I think that that's important. Look, you can go all the way back to almost a year ago, more than a year ago, when we actually obtained some of the first filings in this Flynn case, where the government in the first instance turned over some documents that up until then they had kept hidden. And that included, for instance, some notes that former Deputy Director Andrew McCabe had written to himself. And that's when we got the central picture here about how Flynn had been set up. He'd been sandbagged. And that was incredibly obvious even from those notes back then. What we've since obtained in this most recent filing is a lot more details about just how deliberate that was and who all was involved. So some pretty damning information included about Jim Comey's role in this and about how he once again ignored his superiors to move ahead with this whole plot. And obviously some of those notes that make clear that the top leadership of the DOJ wanted to use this to set a perjury trap or to get Flynn fired.
Why Flynn?
I think there's a couple of reasons. One, and Andy McCarthy, the former federal prosecutor, has pointed out that Flynn, as the former director, was one of the few people that would likely be in a position as national security advisor to unravel what the FBI and the intelligence agencies had been doing over the past 9 months with regard to Trump. The other person would have been Jeff Sessions as the new AG. And that's why they worked so hard also to get rid of him immediately by forcing him to recuse himself.
Do you think, by the way, in retrospect, that he should have recused himself?
Absolutely not. Especially because he knew he had done nothing wrong. Here's the thing. The bad guys in all this had the benefit of knowing exactly what was going on and what they were doing, whereas nobody else did. And so it allowed them to stay 10 steps ahead of the game. So remember, when Sessions came under that extraordinary pressure to recuse himself, we had no idea of just how deeply in it the FBI was. No one understood that this was going to be a three-year drama.
I love this country. I'm starting to think that I may have had slightly too high an opinion of some of our elite institutions. Has that happened to you?
I feel very much as you do, but I think I had too much faith in the leadership of some of our institutions.
This February, a 25-year-old black man was shot and killed in southeast Georgia. His name, Ahmaud Arbery. Suspiciously, it took local law enforcement 73 days to unearth the probable facts and bring charges. Two individuals were arrested and charged with murder. It's a horribly sad, terrible injustice, and if you've seen the video, you know why. But some key leaders have not, however, been behaving responsibly in discussing this murder. Here's my colleague, Larry Elder.
The mayor of Atlanta said because of President Trump's rhetoric, quote, many who are prone to being racist are given permission to do it in an overt way we wouldn't see in 2020. LeBron James tweeted this, and this is a quote. We're literally hunted every day, every time, he put that in big bold letters, we step foot outside the comfort of our homes. My prayers and blessings sent to the family, I presume. How often does it happen that a black person is killed by a white person? How often does it happen? One recent year, 2015, 229 black people were killed by whites. That same year, 500 whites were killed by blacks. Of the homicides in this country, half of them are black victim, black perp, roughly half. Almost all are men. Almost all are young. So when you look at the percentage of young black men in the population, that's around 3%. So you're talking about 3% of the population committing almost half of the homicides. Let's talk about interracial, non-homicide crimes. 85% of the cases involve a black perp and a white victim, only 15% the other way around. 7,000 blacks were killed. Most of those blacks were killed by other blacks last year. This means a young black man is at least 7 times more likely to be a victim of a homicide than a young white man. Did Obama's anti-cop rhetoric get blamed for the death of execution-style killing of cops in New York, in Dallas, and in Baton Rouge, Louisiana? Is this thing on? Race relations have, in fact, improved based upon polls since President Trump's been in office. They declined precipitously during the last 2 years Obama was in office. Did the mayor suggest that Obama's rhetoric was responsible for that? Is this thing on?
Coming up, former Israeli U.S. Ambassador Michael Oren.
Today, Israel faces no conventional threats. From an historical perspective, this is nothing short of one of probably the greatest story in modern history.
Israel's political tragic comedy when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more about the deadline for application at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF. Alliance Defending Freedom. Three elections in a year and now two prime ministers and a midnight session of Israel's Supreme Court. The result? Basic laws are changed and a political anomaly in Israel is legal. Even on a normal day, Israeli politics are confusing, but this was something entirely new. Former Israeli U.S. Ambassador Michael Oren recently joined me to help Americans sort through this confusion. Let's get to the government. It appears from the Times of Israel this morning that all the laws that need passing are being passed and the government will stand up. Is that your view?
That is the view. And over the last couple of weeks, I've talked about whether the high court would approve changes in Israel's basic laws. We don't have a constitution like Great Britain. We have a collection of basic laws which set out how governments are formed, how they're elected, how long they stay in office. And you had to change a whole series of laws in order to get a government which basically has two prime ministers on a rotational basis. It has the largest number of ministers in Israeli history and vice ministers. And half the ministers are answerable to one prime minister, and other half of the ministers are answerable to another prime minister, and basically freezes legislation for a half a year for the coronavirus, no high-level appointments. Imagine the White House saying to Congress, you can't pass legislation for half a year. That would require a major constitutional change in the United States as well. I was questioning whether the Supreme Court, which has been a very activist Supreme Court, would step up and say, no, you can't change all these basic laws overnight. But then I also said that the Supreme Court was afraid. They were afraid that they had pushed, they'd become too activist, that the Knesset would then turn to the Supreme Court and say, you weren't elected, we're the sovereign, you're not, and we're going to override a Supreme Court decision. Well, the Supreme Court, I think, blinked. And what happened is they said, well, we're not going to interfere. There are a lot of questions here, but we're not going to interfere. And the legislation was passed last night, changes to the basic law, May 13th, another couple of days, and Israel will finally have, after a very long break, will finally have a government.
So tell me about the security situation on 75 years after victory in Europe, 75 years after the last camp was liberated. Where is Israel today in terms of its security?
You know, I look back to May 8th, 1945, VE Day. You know, my father got, we still have at home, my parents' home, the flyers that were dropped by B-17 bombers over Europe saying, you know, Nazis quit. That was the headline.
Oh, wow.
And all the world was dancing. All the world was dancing, except for one man, David Ben-Gurion, who was the future prime minister of Israel, our founding father, who wrote in his diary, it's very sad. It's sad because a third of the world's Jews had been killed and massacred by the Nazis. Now, who on May 8th would think that 3 years after that, almost to the day, May 14th, 1948, a sovereign Jewish state would be created in the state of Israel? And it would defend itself against invasions. It would absorb hundreds of thousands, millions of refugees. It would create a democracy in the Middle East. It would create a thriving, flourishing intellectual and technological life. And it's amazing when you look from a historical perspective what this state has done. And today, Israel faces no conventional threats. We've had peace with Egypt, peace with Jordan. The Syrians are busy elsewhere. Our biggest threat is still terror in the form of Hezbollah and Hamas and Iran, and Iran's nuclear project. So we can't, you know, rest on any laurels. And there was a rocket fired the other night from Gaza, for example. We still have to deal with this. But from an historical perspective, this is nothing short of one of the, probably the greatest story in modern history.
Michael Waltz is a first-term congressman from Florida's 6th, the first Green Beret to serve in Congress. Lieutenant Colonel Waltz is also clear-eyed about China and the future of the U.S.-China relations. We spoke recently on the Hugh Hewitt Show. That means you'll have a Gallagher Marine. You're a Green Beret. We got a Navy pilot, so we got, I'm sure there's some swabbies as well, some swells, but are there any Air Force people in Congress at all?
Yeah, there actually is. There's a retired one-star by the name of Don Bacon out of Nebraska. He's a great member. But, you know, the bigger, he's fantastic. Look, I never make Air Force jokes. They saved my life on multiple occasions.
Let's get to this bill that Nancy Pelosi entered. They really did. They put in the relief bill cash for cannabis. Mitch McConnell has one priority, which is getting businesses to reopen free of plaintiffs' lawyers picking over their bones. And right. She wants a bailout for marijuana businesses.
Yeah, I think we're running out of green ink in Washington, D.C., as much money as we're printing. Even if she got this through, she won't. You know, the Senate will stop it, thank God. But she's already telling the most progressive members that it's okay, we didn't get everything in this one. There'll be another one this summer. We face two existential threats for this country. One is an America led by socialists, and two is a world led by Chinese communists. And this is the fight of, I think, the rest of our adult lives.
Well, they gave us a gift yesterday in the first fight because they gave us the gift of transparency. It's a $3 trillion throwaway. I mean, if you know what the other side wants, you have a huge advantage. And I would just pin that on every Democrat running. They want $3 trillion in bogus stuff instead of focusing on getting businesses reopened like McConnell and the Senate is doing. And I know you guys would do if you had the majority, you would be focused on getting businesses reopened. All right, let's talk now about China. I think we're in Cold War 2.0, and
I agree.
I cut my teeth with Richard Nixon at the age of 22. Call the world as it exists, not as you want it to be, but as it is. And the way it is right now is that General Secretary Xi is opposed to it. I mean, he's our enemy.
Well, look, this is, you know, from with all due respect to Richard and others who have believed for the longest time that capitalism would change China, that our openness would cheat, you know, we should lead with our chin in the boxing ring and they'll be nice and they'll play along. And that thinking absolutely has to change. You know, the Chinese explicitly, it's in Xi's speeches. It's in his leaders' speeches that they seek to dominate us economically by stealing our technology. And then that will make the military domination almost a fait accompli. And I think the best analogy is essentially how the United Kingdom at post-World War II just slid aside. It was just kind of accepted that the United States was the new global leader. And that's what the Chinese, I mean, people are talking about a military conflict. You know, in Chinese thinking and military strategy, if it comes to a military conflict, they've failed.
Yeah.
They want us to essentially slide aside. And if we keep spending ourselves into oblivion, like Pelosi wants us to do, they're playing right into their hands. The other thing, we cannot underestimate their misinformation campaign. It is happening in our think tanks, like Richard's. It's happening in our local and state officials. One of my other Democratic opponents just called me a racist because I introduced a bill to stop our technology theft in our universities with 400,000 Chinese students coming here per year. Doesn't make them bad kids. They are forced by their government to vacuum up everything they see from robotics to AI. And then also calling out these professors. Two more were just arrested from Emory University and University of Arkansas, pocketing $500,000, $500,000 a year from the Wuhan Institute of Technology. At the same time, they're accepting tens of millions of dollars in DOD and NIH, Defense Department research funding. This has to stop, and we're going to stop it with this new China task force that we just set up in the House.
Coming up.
We're talking about I own a restaurant and some customer 2 weeks later gets the virus and now I get hit with a lawsuit by some opportunistic employee claiming that they got it on that night in my restaurant. But the cost of litigating it alone is probably going to put me out of business, defending myself. That's a real problem.
Senator Marco Rubio, when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Hey, thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Our podcast is sponsored by Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose liberty is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-691-8969. That's 800-691-8969. Or visit townhallreview.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The economic costs of the coronavirus and the government response, shutting down so much economic activity, has been brutal. All of us remember when our economy was humming along with record high employment and a bright economic future. And then it happened, suddenly. Businesses, stadiums, venues, schools closed. That snowballed in the shutdown of countless goods and services vendors. What is it going to take to get this all up and running again? Florida Senator Marco Rubio chairs the Senate Small Business Committee. He was a guest on my program. I think the refilling the PPP tank is definitely going to be on the table. But talk to me, Senator Rubio, your chair of small business. A lot of these small businesses will not reopen if the plaintiff's bar is there like vultures to pick on their bones. I don't know how we reopen the country without some kind of liability protection. Are you part of the working group on that issue?
Well, I'm not on the working group on the issue, but it's certainly relevant to what we're working on in terms of getting small businesses support. They are by far the most vulnerable to that sort of activity. Look, we're not talking about excusing gross negligence here, okay? You know, some guy knows he has the virus and decides he's going to infect a bunch of people, even though he's the business owner. I'm not talking about that. We're talking about I own a restaurant and some customer 2 weeks later gets the virus and now I get hit with a lawsuit by some opportunistic employee claiming that they got it on that night in my restaurant. But the cost of litigating it alone is probably going to put me out of business, defending myself. That's a real problem. There are two hidden impediments to reopening parts of our economy. One is litigation and the other is schools. I mean, you can't get people back to work if their 9-year-old kid has to be home all day by themselves. So we've got two big impediments out there that we need to address for purposes of getting back to the somewhere or getting to some new normal until we have a vaccine.
I talked with the vice president yesterday about a do-over year for schools, and he's chewing on that. But let's focus on this liability protection. There are precedents for picking a federal district court district, whether it's Eastern District of Texas or the Southern District of New York. They do the royalties cases. The Eastern District does patent litigation, I believe. You pick one district of the federal courts and you say all tort claims based on COVID are going here. And then you set a standard, which is, I think, reckless indifference to best practices when it comes to sanitation. How hard is that to do, Senator Rubio?
No, I think it's not hard to do mechanically. I think it's hard to do politically. It's no secret that the trial bar is a major contributor to Democratic Party. In fact, I don't know, this has been really grossly underreported, but there was efforts a month before all this thing broke open. You know, the masks that 3M makes, you know, the masks that are now widely being used to protect people, the N93 mask, whatever the number is, those masks, those are the same masks that they use for industrial purposes. And so there was an effort in legislation to allow that to be mass produced and used for that purpose. And it was blocked by Democrats on behalf of the trial bar, who wanted to be able to sue. And didn't, there was a liability issue there. Now, ultimately, they relented. My point is, they could have started rolling that out a long earlier. So it's just an example of the hold the trial bar has over the Democratic Party. So I think the impediment really is getting it passed, not so much implementing once it is.
Now, your colleague, Senator Scott, has said on this show he does not want to give any money to blue states that have been badly managed and red states that have been badly managed. He's not indifferent. He just cares about management. To me, it seems that the Democrats have got to have bailouts for places like Illinois that have already borrowed $12 billion from the Treasury. Isn't that going to be the trade-off, some additional relief for state and local governments and their employees and their unions in exchange for protecting America's small businesses from the plaintiff's bar? Isn't that the essential elements of a deal?
Yeah, I mean, I think you could see something like that coming together from a political and bargaining perspective. I would say that when it comes to local and state governments, I want to be clear about this. There are two separate things here. Number one is money you owe, liabilities you have because of mismanagement and bad decisions. We should not be bailing that out. And then there is some sort of basic baseline of revenue that you need to pay firefighters and garbage, you know, pickup people and the sanitation department and your building and code division and your firefighters and police officers. There's a baseline revenue there that we can't allow to decline. Now, our system of federalism relies on local governments providing these basic services. And so there's a difference between funding those basic services, which they may need some help on, and extra money to help them service the debt they took on because they've mismanaged their pension fund. And again, I think it would be terrible precedent to use this crisis as an opportunity to allow them to come here and get bailed out for bad decisions on the pension side. But there is a baseline of operational revenue that local and state governments need to provide essential services, and that we cannot allow to collapse.
I agree. Last quick question, Senator. You almost retired. The Orlando shooting persuaded you not to. Are you glad you came back for a time such as this?
I can tell you that my second term has been much more rewarding and a lot, and I've gotten a lot more done. I think a lot of that has to do with being in the majority in the Senate and obviously also having the White House. My relationship with the White House is very good, and we've gotten a lot of things done, both in legislation and in executive, through executive actions. Because of it. So it's. I am glad. I'm very, very happy the work we've been doing.
Coming up.
Absolutely a perjury trap if you read everything that's been released publicly about it. You know, I want to be clear that the fundamental issue, as I've listened to Barr, is the predication for all of these investigations.
Matthew Whitaker on his book, Above the Law. When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more about the deadline for application at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. During the darkest times for the Trump Department of Justice, Attorney General Jeff Sessions was pressured out of his job. He was replaced for 3 brief months by Matthew Whitaker, his former chief of staff, who was appointed acting attorney general in November of 2018. Whitaker is out with a new book, nicely timed for this week. The title, Above the Law, the inside story of how the Justice Department tried to subvert President Trump. Whitaker was a guest of my Salem colleague, Sebastian Gorka.
If you think about everything we were told about the Flynn case, it really didn't start to unravel until recently when Sidney Powell got into some of the documents that showed the strategies, tactics, techniques that were used to essentially take a counterintelligence investigation that was being closed and turn that into a counterintelligence investigation weapon to create a perjury trap, as General Barr explained, a perjury trap against General Flynn.
So let's be clear here. We're talking about the new counsel. So Covington and Burley were General Flynn's representatives for several years, cost him millions of dollars, held information back, didn't do the job they should have done. They're fired. In comes Sidney Powell and finds out all this evidence that the FBI and others have been sitting on. And this isn't an exaggeration. You have to call this a perjury trap, correct, Matt?
Absolutely. It is absolutely a perjury trap. If you read all of the everything that's been released publicly about it, unfortunately, this is just recent revelations. And, you know, I want to be clear that the fundamental issue, and that really the fundamental issue, as I've listened to Barr and based on what I know and based on what I talk about in the book, is the predication for all of these investigations.
Meaning the justification.
Yeah. So you have to have essentially, some evidence, some facts that lead you to open an investigation. And it's very clear. And based on what I've read and what Barr's talked about and what I know, Comey in the Flynn instance didn't have predication for starting that investigation and even going to interview him.
No crime.
No crime, but also avoided the Department of Justice, also avoided following traditional FBI policies and procedures.
Stop there. You're a mind reader. We have the audio in which Jim Comey publicly admits this and laughs about the fact how he went around procedure to set up that interview, which would entrap my friend Mike Flynn. This is Jim Comey, then director of the FBI when this occurred, with Nicole Wallace, Cut 9.
You look at this White House now, and it's hard to imagine two FBI agents ending up in the sit room. How did that happen?
I sent them. Something I probably wouldn't have done or maybe gotten away with in a more organized investigation, a more organized administration, in the George W. Bush administration, for example, or the Obama administration. In both of those administrations, there was process. And so if the FBI wanted to send agents into the White House itself to interview a senior official, you would work through the White House counsel, and there'd be discussions and approvals and who would be there. And I thought, it's early enough, let's just send a couple guys over.
That is the admission. The book is Above the Law from Regnery. You can pre-order it now. It's by the former acting attorney general in studio, Matt Whitaker. It is the inside story of how the Justice Department tried to subvert President Trump. A question that I've been asked more than once, and I need you to answer the question because you have the capacity to do so. Jim Comey, stroke, McCabe.
What? You mean the people on the cover of my book?
Right, the people on the cover of your book. What can they be charged with? We have all these kind of fancy, abuse of power under the color of law, obstruction of justice. I've looked these up. These all usually lead to small bore prosecutions, not a big deal. This is seditious. This is trying to undermine a duly elected president. So what legal jeopardy, Matt Whitaker, are these people in now? Comey, stroke, McCabe.
Yeah. So at least two of them, Comey and McCabe, have been looked at previously, coming out of the OIG investigations, the leak investigations, and all of that. And they've declined to prosecute. We've heard that from General Barr, and we've heard that from the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Columbia. Based on now what we're hearing and what we know, there may be new options for prosecution. And as I listened to the Herridge interview, which she does such a great job interviewing General Barr, she was asking him essentially what are the consequences for this prosecution that you've now dismissed. And, you know, he was very careful, but he said a couple things that we need to remember, that John Durham continues to look at the criminality of all these individuals that were involved. And in addition, not just at the Department of Justice, but within the entire U.S. government, and that includes Clapper
The declination to bring charges on Comey and others with regards to mishandling of information, that doesn't create a double jeopardy trap. So there could still be charges and grand juries for all of these people.
Yes.
On what charges?
Well, this is the hardest thing, and you know, because I'm a lawyer trained in the law, and I'm a prosecutor, and I know how careful you should be.
Yeah.
Not how careful but these
just
folks
theoretically,
are.
What yeah. categories do they fall into?
Theoretically, you know, I think you have sort of that category. You have potentially 18 USC. I think it's either 101 or one, the misprison of a felony. I think you have, you know.
The what of a felony?
Misprison of a felony.
Misprison yes, of a felony.
That's one of,
which means what?
Prosecutors. You know, essentially that you knew that others were committing crimes and didn't do anything about it. So it's a sort of an aiding and abetting theory. It could be used depending on what the underlying facts are. You know, Barr, Durham, and then this Jeff Jensen, who's a very under-the-radar U.S. attorney out of St. Louis.
Former FBI special
yes,
agent.
Yes, and he's a rock star.
Who was key to yesterday's decision.
He was the one that was tasked with figuring out this Flynn case.
We've got 60 seconds left. The book is Above the Law from my publishers, Regnery. Order it now. Pre-order it now. Message to the American people. Should we have hope that there will be charges brought and that justice will be done, Matt Whitaker?
Yep. If charges can be brought, they will be brought. Bill Barr is the absolute right person to restore trust in the Department of Justice and the FBI, and I look forward to this chapter being behind us and us to move on with the important work of protecting the American people.
For the complete Corco Whitaker interview, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up.
Here's the headline I saw. Sweden sees higher coronavirus death rate. Their death rate is 297.16 for every 1 million citizens. You want to know what ours is? Ours is 226.33 deaths per 1 million people, according to the data.
We'll look at Sweden and their approach to the coronavirus in the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt in a moment.
If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it, you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, perhaps the greatest scandal of our time.
President Obama, quite frankly, may have orchestrated this whole thing.
A look at the effort to stifle conservatives.
They're actually limiting the areas on campus in which they can speak, even after they get permission.
Much of the country remains shut down.
52% of American counties have had zero, that's zero, COVID-19 deaths.
And is there a silver lining in all of this?
40% of Christians and 22% of non-Christians say that people are more open spiritually these days because of the pandemic.
We've got all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Sweden was the only country that did not follow its Scandinavian neighbors in shutting down to avert a COVID-19 pandemic. Sweden is still early in the death rate analysis, but the country has bested some of the larger EU countries in avoiding an economic crisis. Here's my Salem colleague, Mike Gallagher, to do the comparison.
Let me share this headline. The New York Post: Sweden sees higher coronavirus death rate than U.S. after refusing lockdown. Now, remember the other day I got the call from the big liberal young lady in Massachusetts, Emma in Massachusetts. And she did, you know, she lied to my screener and said, oh, I really support the governors opening up the states. Then she went opposite and I knew she would. And that's all right. And she said, all the scientists and the experts agree that shutting down the country saved millions of lives, lots of lives. And I said, but Emma, what do you have to compare it to? And I got to thinking about it afterwards. Let's look at Sweden. It's not exactly the North Pole. It's not the United States, but there are big populated areas of Sweden like Stockholm. So they didn't lock down. Here's the headline I saw. Sweden sees higher coronavirus death rate. Their death rate is 297.16 for every 1 million citizens, right? This is data provided by Johns Hopkins University. You want to know what ours is? Ours is 226.33 deaths per 1 million people, according to the data. Now, it's terrible, It's awful for Sweden. It's awful for United States. It's awful for the world. Can I repeat those two numbers for you for just a minute? The United States, which locked down, turned out the lights, shut us down. Now we got 14.7% unemployment with 20.5 million jobs lost in April alone. We have a death rate of 226.33 deaths per 1 million people. Sweden has 297.16 deaths for every 1 million citizens. Do you understand my point? Their death rate isn't that dramatically higher than ours, despite the sort of deceptive headline in the New York Post. Further, Sweden still trails behind hard-hit European countries like the United Kingdom, France, and Spain, which all implemented lockdowns. And Sweden, as you know, left most schools, stores, and restaurants open, instead calling on residents to self-regulate themselves when it comes to social distancing from one another. I think this is profound. I believe this is such a huge bit of data that helps us understand how to go forward. We can't go back. We can't undo what's been done. But my gosh, they didn't shut down, and we did? Maybe the opposition to the shutdown has a point. And maybe it's time to start opening this country up again. Of course we have to be careful. Of course we have to be safe. Of course we have to protect the vulnerable. But what do you make of these numbers?
Thank you for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for the daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schubert and producer Charlie Richards, David Posian, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, Ben Brigman, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.